My name is Billy, St. Denis. I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here. Glad to be sober. I always start off anywhere I speak by saying that because there was a time when I was not glad to be sober. I actually went to my first AA meeting in 1979. I did not get sober until November 7th of 1990. That's my sobriety date. Even though I went to my first meeting in February of 1979. And I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I would have to say, you know, is there anybody in their first 30, 60, or 90 days in the room tonight? How you doing? Welcome. Keep coming back. It's always important that I ask that because I'm basically talking to you, you know. The old timers have heard lots of stories and stuff, but you know, I was at the age of 19. I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was really it was through my little brother Joe, because Joe was the one who was, you know, he was the real down and out alcoholic who got to Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 16. You know, I started my drinking. I think I took my first drink probably around 8 or 9 years old. You know, I wasn't an alcoholic at 8 or 9 years old, but there's no reason why an 8 or 9 year old should be drinking beer in the sewer, you know. I lived across the street from a kid who was a good friend of mine, and you know, we rode bikes together, and, you know, shot squirrels and stuff like that. And his dad was an alcoholic. Every Friday he would buy 10 cases of Budweiser, and he had a separate refrigerator for it in the basement. And he said to his son Bryce, he said, "Don't ever touch my beer." So you know what that means. I mean, we had to touch it. You know what I mean? We knew we weren't supposed to be drinking it, so we took some, you know. And I remember going in the sewer, and there was another kid named Dave there, and over by our house by the woods, you know, and we drank a couple of them. And, you know, I liked the way it made me feel, you know. I think I drank two of them, you know, two 12-ounce Budweisers. And got a little buzz, but, you know, I didn't really think much about it at 8, 9 years old, you know. And it would be, oh, probably about another 3 or 4 years, however old you are in seventh grade and junior high school, before I took a drink again, you know. I was more interested in playing basketball and, you know, eating candy at the 7-Eleven after picking up pop bottles. You know, that's, I had a pretty idyllic childhood, you know. My folks were both, they're not alcoholics, they're both professionals, you know. My father worked at the National Institute of Health. He helped that get that National Library of Medicine going. Very educated people. My, you know, World War II veteran. My mother was an attorney back in the day when, you know, women were not. She was the only woman in her class. She graduated from Catholic University Law School in 1952. So she's like one of the pioneers as far as being a lawyer, you know. And I grew up in I would say it was a pretty, my folks were older when they got married. You know, my father had already been married and his first wife died. I didn't find this out. My father was a very stoic man, too, you know. He really didn't communicate well. He was one of these, like, kind of like tough guy, World War II, you know. He'd gone off to the war at, like, 19, him and his brothers, 18 and 21, you know. One of his brothers, Richard, actually, got killed over in the Pacific. The reason I mention that, because this woman wrote a book about him being lost last year. It's called Unbroken, and it was about the fellas that went to find his plane, and then their plane got lost, and then a bunch of them died, but a few of them survived, and she wrote this story about that. I mean, they were looking for my Uncle Richard, you know. And my father just had a terrible time with that. He was very talented and really a brilliant man. He's a linguist. He probably speaks, I want to say, like 12, 13 languages fluently. He can write like 7 or 8, you know. He's involved with the State Department, you know. And, you know, so I had, but he was very quiet, you know. And then he got married after the war and to his high school sweetheart, you know, and when she was pregnant with their first child, she ended up, she was diagnosed with cancer, and she died with the baby before the baby was born. And I didn't know this until I was 16 years old. You know, I just thought my mother was the only, and this is the, like the generation that I grew up around, you know, they just didn't talk about things, you know. My mother was, she had lost her father at a very young age too, you know. So my mother was very loving and kind and kind of outspoken and just, you know, I thought she was bossy as a kid, you know. But she, really looking back, she was just instilled very good values in all of us, you know. So I was given a proper upbringing, you know. My father's probably the most honest man I've ever met in my life, you know. And what does that have to do with my alcoholism? Absolutely nothing, other than the fact that, you know, I can tell you, I was not like that, you know. I remember feeling, you know, pretty afraid very young. I seemed to have trouble in relationships with others. I fought with people. I was kind of a troublemaker is what I was, you know. I fluctuated between, I wanted to be either Pistol Pete Maravich or Evel Knievel. I know Pete died of alcoholism, you know, and Evel Knievel, you know, was pretty banged up, you know. So I was always doing something. I was one of these kids. I spent my childhood in the emergency room, you know. I mean, just crazy stuff, you know. I'd be jumping the creek, you know, on some ramp that we had made and hit a tree and bust my head open. And I just, you know, just crazy stuff. And so when I started drinking, it was like, I was ready to start drinking, you know. And I don't know, you know, why I took that first drink. I think it was just because somebody handed it to me, you know. I do remember it was like one of those Boone Farms wine. I don't know what it was, like apple or, you know, whatever. It tasted pretty good. It was at a dance and stuff like that. But shortly after that, I had my first drunk, actually, was, the reason this is important, more now than it used to be, I used to hang around with these two kids, Stevie and Johnny. Stevie and Johnny were like, you know, they were like running buddies of mine in junior high school. And, one of their brother's daughter has just come to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I've been thinking a lot about them the last couple of weeks, you know. Their older brother, Richard, one of his daughters has come all banged up to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And she said, "I heard you knew my uncles." I was like, "Yeah." And they both died from their alcoholism, you know. Stevie ended up in prison, and he ended up having a drug overdose. So, I mean, we don't end up like, you know, they say jails, institutions, and death. That's where we end up, you know. But his dad was he was quite a successful, like, real estate developer and lawyer. And, you know, he had this big house in Kensington, kind of where I live, you know, outside of Washington. And I remember he used to keep his liquor in a cage in the basement, you know, like with the accordion style, and it was all there in racks, you know. I mean, he had a fancy wine cooler and everything. And I was like, why the hell does he keep it in a cage, you know? And they said, to keep it away from us, you know, because he had a bunch of teenage kids, a couple of older ones, Stevie and Johnny. But I was a real skinny kid, you know. I had a kind of a small head and small arms. And they said, if we hold you up, I'll bet you can squeeze your head and your arm in between those little diamonds. He said, grab the first bottle you can grab. So they did. I got my arm all the way in there. And I got stuck. It took me a while to get out of there. I was stuck in there. I had the bottle, and I'm stuck, and they're pulling me out. But it turned out to be Jack Daniel's Black Label Bourbon. So I made a good pick right now. That would become my main drink for the next 20 years, Jack Daniel's Black Label. And we took that back to a kid's house who was having a party in the neighborhood, you know, and we sat around drinking that. Me and Stevie and Johnny and a couple other guys. And I probably drank half the bottle and they drank, you know, the rest, you know. And I got really drunk. I mean, after all, I'm the one who stole it, so, you know, I should drink more. Went inside the people's house. I threw up all over his parents' furniture. They called my dad. He took me to the hospital. They pumped my stomach. You know, I had alcohol poisoning. I probably should have died, you know. I was only probably about 97 pounds soaking wet. And, you know, but that was my first experience with, like, a real drunk, you know. And I remember I was in a lot of trouble. I had to go back and apologize to those people. What made it worse was they were Mormons. I know a lot about Mormons now, but I didn't at the time. I come to find out that Mormons, they don't drink, they don't smoke, you know, I don't think they do anything, you know. I mean, well, I guess they have kids, but and extra wives, but some, maybe not anymore, I don't know. But I ended up, you know, getting in a lot of trouble, you know. I remember cutting lawns, you know, half the summer to pay for, to have this antique furniture cleaned. And, you know, I was in a lot of trouble. I had to dress up in a suit. It was embarrassing. You know, so I was, like I said, I was raised right, you know, but I remember that feeling it gave me. I was like, God, I can't wait to do this again, you know. I just can't wait to do this again. And I was already planning my next drunk, you know, being in all that trouble, you know. And that's basically what my drinking went like for the next 20 years, you know. When I would get in trouble, I would cool it for a little bit, and then I would, you know, go back to the races because I had the allergy of the body and obsession of the mind. You know, as soon as I took that first drink, you know, Katie barred the door. You know, I started drinking and really kind of, you know, I was racing cars and motorcycles, and my dad, you know, my dad was like, he would come home, he would shake, I remember very clearly, he would shake his head and go, "What is wrong with you?" He would be, "What's wrong with you?" You know, you ever get that lecture, you know? And I would be like, "Nothing. I'm fine." You know, I'd be in trouble, you know, doing this or that. You know, I remember one time he loved this thing too. He had one of them big giant Winnebagos that he had bought. You know, he'd saved up. He got like this big giant motorhome. I don't know what it was called. Indian Chief or something. This was in the 70s, you know. And me and my friends were sitting around. We were drinking and getting high, and we ran out of some smoking substance, and one of the other kids said he had some over in his house, but it was a couple of miles away, and we didn't want to, like, walk over there, you know, and nobody had a car, so I was like, we'll take the Winnebago, you know? I mean, hell, I've been driving since I was 12. He didn't know that, but, you know, I'd been stealing his car at night, you know, to go out, so I remember I took the Winnebago over, and you know, I'm kind of half messed up, and I ran into a tree. I mean, a tree, like, stuck in the top of the thing, you know, and broke off the branch, you know. And we got out, and we looked at it, and we're like, God, this is awful. And, you know, you're going to be in so much trouble, you know. And then we got back in it, and you know, the guys were like, well, we better take it back. And I was like, no way. We got to go get the stuff first. You know? We drove over, got the stuff, got messed up. You know, that's the only time my old man ever, like, hit me. I mean, he basically punched me in the face that day. I think I was, like, 14 years old, you know. And both my folks would threaten to send me, like, forestry camp or something like that, but they didn't, you know. They didn't. They were nice people. They just figured, you know, if they gave me a good lecture and, you know, gave me some consequences, you know, like restriction-type consequences, that I'd straighten out eventually and everything would be fine, you know. But it just got worse, you know. And I remember a friend of mine, when I was 16, he got stabbed to death next to me at another party, you know, kind of a drunken brawl over a girl, you know. I remember thinking to myself, alcohol caused this, I'm not going to drink anymore, you know. But it wasn't powerful enough for my alcoholism, you know. A couple weeks later, I started drinking again. Somebody came by the house, handed me a beer, you know. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time when I was 19 years old. That's how old I was in 1979. And the 70s were kind of a blur to me, you know. I remember my sister, you know, she started drinking, and then I turned my little brother on to it. He was 3 years younger than me. Suzanne, my sister Suzanne, is sober now 25 years, so she got sober before me. In my family, I like to say it's AA or Amen, you know, basically, you know. But I spent a lot of my youth. I remember one time my sister ran away to follow some boy down to the Mardi Gras in New Orleans, and I think about this. I would never do this with my kids, but my parents, I guess they looked at me as being kind of like, I seemed like I knew what I was doing. I was always pretending like I was, but I really didn't, you know. My mother gave me the keys to her station wagon and a credit card and $500 in cash and said, "Go find your sister. She's at the Mardi Gras." She was 15. I was 16. You know what I mean? So you know what happened. I got down there. I showed her picture to, like, some cop on the street in the French Quarter. And he said, "This is Mardi Gras." He goes, "We're locking up 100 people every day." He goes, "Just look around, you know." So we spent all my mother's money getting drunk for a week, and I just happened to run into her on the last day of the month. You know, and I said, I called up, I said, "Mom, I found her. It wasn't easy, but I found her." By the way, there isn't any money left. You know, $500 went up. Because we were supposed to spend it on a hotel, but we didn't, you know. I remember we stayed in this dead lady's driveway. We were parking on the street by Tulane University trying to, you know, trying to take showers for free and eat in the cafeteria like we were students. And then this old woman comes out and she goes, "Are you guys sleeping in your cars?" And we were like, "Yeah." She's like, "Well, my neighbor just died. Park in her driveway and the police won't hassle you." So we spent the week in the dead lady's driveway. And I remember being pissed because I thought to myself, why can't you just let us in the house? Nobody's living there. You know, lucky we didn't get locked up. But, you know, it was kind of like that. I just basically did whatever I wanted to do, you know. As a young kid, my folks raised me well, but I was an absolute criminal, you know. I was racing cars, stealing cars, breaking in, you know, just doing a lot of stuff. I got involved in drugs. I was hanging out with the Grateful Dead. You know, that kind of scene. You know what I mean? And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 19 years old. And I'd been thrown out of my house shortly after that Mardi Gras thing. You know, I came home and my old man, I used to grow marijuana. And I thought that that was... I didn't really think that that was drugs. It was organic. But he came home one day, and the whole house reeked, you know, because I was trying to speed up the process of drying it out so that I could get it out the door, you know what I mean? And he was like, he came home, and he was like, you know, "Your mother's an attorney. She'll lose her job," you know, So he basically kicked me out of the house at 16. Well, I didn't move far. I just moved across the railroad tracks, you know, with some other kids that were like me, around the same age. You know, we rented out these abandoned buildings. We called ourselves the Hole in the Floor Gang. It was an abandoned fuel oil company across the tracks. And it was like one of those places where it had probably been abandoned for about 30 years, you know, because of zoning and stuff. But we somehow got the electricity back on, and we got the water to go on, but there was no water heater. It was only cold water, you know. And we rented the place for, it was two buildings. It was a small building with two bedrooms and then a little bigger house, you know, with like a kitchen and stuff. We rented the two buildings for $33 a month from the old man that owned it. And we had trouble making rent some months. It was hard. It was $11 a piece, you know. I don't know why I'm telling that story. I just think about the crazy shit I did when I was young, and it's like amazing that I'm still here. But I ended up moving into a little bit nicer house with some guys, and I ended up, you know, in downtown Bethesda. This is before it became like the swanky place that it is today, you know. And I was living in with a bunch of guys that were basically like me. You know, we had like Harleys on the porch, and we had a pool table in the living room. We had drilled a hole in the fridge, and we kept like a keg on tap, you know, and we were drunk all the time. If we had any food, it was on coolers on the back porch, you know. And I remember nobody bought any toilet paper. I used to steal mine from the gas station and hide it. Because I wasn't spending any beer money on toilet paper. You know what I mean? It was that mentality, you know? Living large. But I came home one day and I'd had a really bad week. You know, I had wrecked one of my cars. I had a couple. I always had a spare in case I wrecked one. Because I was always wrecking cars. I mean, I don't know about you guys. But, you know, I'd be drunk and I'd be like, they're like, "What happened?" You know, I'm like, "This tree jumped out in front of me," you know? And I would just make up some story and leave the scene. And back then, they didn't throw you in jail for that, you know? I was trying to avoid a dog, you know? "Well, why didn't you stay with the car, you know? I needed to get to work the next morning." Well, that wasn't true because I'd been fired, you know? And I ended up... you know, I ended up coming home one day. My favorite girlfriend had left me. I always had a spare back then. I know that ladies don't like to hear that, but that's what I was like, you know. I had so much fear. I thought, well, as soon as I would get in a relationship with a girl that I liked, I thought, well, she's going to leave me. She doesn't really like me. So then I'd get another one. In case she left me, then I'd have another one, you know. But then they'd usually both find out, and they'd both leave me at the same time, and there I'd be. This happened a lot back then. You know? And I talked to, I remember I talked to my first sponsor about that, and he's like, why'd you act like that? And I said, I don't know. I guess I was afraid or something. And he's like, well, you know, that wasn't very nice. And I said, well, I wasn't a very nice guy. I was trying to be, but I wasn't, you know. And so I come home, and my folks are there, and my brother's there, and they're sitting in the living room, and they wanted to talk to me about my drinking, you know. And my rent was due, and I didn't have it, and I'd been fired, and, you know, I just had a really bad week, you know, how you have, like, a bad week, you know. I'd been beat up in a drunken brawl, you know, so I had, like, a, you know, I was just kind of a mess, you know. And they were like, you know, we want you to talk to this doctor. I talked to this doctor. His name was, break his anonymity now because he's died. His name was Joe Chambers, and he was a great guy. He helped a lot of people get sober in the Washington area. You know, he was sober a number of years back then. I didn't know that he was an AA at the time, but he was a doctor that knew about alcoholism, and he talked to me about my drinking, you know, and he convinced me to check into a detox up at a hospital in Montgomery County, you know, and I checked into the detox, and they put me in next to a fella who's about my age now. I'm 53 now. He was an older man, you know. To me, that was really old. When you're 19, somebody 53 looks like a geezer, you know. And I'm uncomfortable. I'm detoxing because I'm drinking about a case of beer a day, and the guy's screaming and yelling that he's got bugs crawling on him. You know, I didn't know what was wrong with him, but he had the delirium tremors, you know, which is what happens in late-stage alcoholism, you know. You see and hear things that you don't know, you know. They're not real, you know. And in the morning, he was gone, you know. And Joe came in to talk to me. And so they got Norman. And they were like, you know, I'm like, where's this guy? Well, I was like, what happened to him? And they were like, he died. I'm like, what do you mean he died? He died. And I remember I got real mad at them. I said, you guys put me in this room with this guy. I said, what? To like, you know, make me think that I have a drinking problem and I'm going to end up like him. You know, and Joe looked me square in the eye and he goes, we don't kill people just to impress young punks like you that they should quit drinking. You know, he died because this is what's going to happen to you. So I paused for a minute and then I thought, all right, well, they wanted me to go to a rehab. I went to a rehab. I went to this place called the Seneca House. It was out on Riley's Lock Road in Potomac. And this was, I want to say it was probably like February of 1979. And I met some great people out there. I didn't really understand the protocol. I mean, you know, I knew that you weren't supposed to drink there, you know, or anything like that. You know, I didn't know that you weren't supposed to. I remember I had like some kind of like liaison with one of the patients, and that was a no-no. Some girl that was around my age, you know. They were going to both kick us out, but they didn't. They ended up sending her somewhere else and keeping me there. You know, this was like one of my early, I don't know if that's ever happened to anybody in rehab, but, you know. So I was just like a lunatic. I was trying to find some way to like, you know, fill that void that I had from drinking and stuff. And I ended up, you know, I ended up going through that program. I found out about the disease of alcoholism. And to be honest with you, at the age of 19, I really thought that I was just too young, you know. I thought, well, you know, and they took me to AA meetings, and I just thought AA meetings were so weird, you know. I mean, I had never been to a place where people talked honestly about, you know, things that they had done, things that they thought, and how they felt. And, you know, this was before they had all those TV shows, so, you know, I always like to say it was pre-Oprah, you know what I mean? I mean, I remember one guy talking about, yeah, you know, and I had an affair with the neighbor, and, you know, my wife left me, and then I lost my job the next day because I lost my security, and I was like, I pulled him aside after the meeting, and I was like, you're not supposed to tell people that, you know? And the guy started laughing at me. I remember he started laughing at me, and he goes, it'll be all right. He goes, you're in the right place. You know, they'd say stuff like that. So I ended up going to a halfway house briefly. They got me a job driving a dump truck in the town of Aberdeen. I don't know if anybody's been to Aberdeen. It's where the Proving Ground is north of Baltimore. And it is the most god-awful place. It is so boring. There's nothing to do there, you know. And the guy they put me with was, he was a drunk. He was basically a 45-year-old drunk. So I'm trying to be sober. I'm 19 years old. I'm driving this dump truck. And the first thing in the morning on the first day, the guy goes, stop at 7-Eleven. He goes, and go in and get me two tall boys of Schlitz malt liquor. So I'm buying this guy beer at 7 o'clock in the morning. He's drinking while I'm driving the dump truck and picking up all the trash while he gets drunk. You know, I'm like, this sobriety thing is not working out. I ended up and this is how crazy we are, you know, me in particular. I did this for 2 weeks. I didn't tell anybody right away. And then they asked me how the job was going. You know, I'm living in the halfway house, you know. The halfway house was like, it was like a living hell to me, you know. I had two single beds, you know, with a nightstand in between and some other guy, you know, who I'm sharing a room with, you know. It was like I was like 8 years old all over again, you know. And there was all these rules. I was like, this is awful. I can't take this. So then I told them. I said, look, I said, this guy gets drunk every day by 9 a.m. Well, they threatened to fire him. They told him that I had told on it. So the next morning, he's chasing me around the parking lot with a tire iron, you know, banging on the truck how he's going to kill me, you know, for screwing up his job. And then I get home from work that night. I'm still like 19. I get home from work, and two of my buddies come by, and they go, "We got an extra ticket to see the Grateful Dead. They're playing the Civic Center in Baltimore. Do you want to come?" And I was like, yeah. And they're like, we support your sobriety, so we brought you some near beer. They didn't have, like, O'Doul's and stuff like that. So they brought me a six-pack of near beer, okay? They're all shit-faced drunk. They're smoking pot. They're dropping acid. We go to the Grateful Dead show. And I got to tell you, it was not that much fun. But I was, like, white-knuckling it. And I did want to be sober. There was a part of me that liked the idea of being sober, you know? I knew this was the right thing to do, you know? There's always a part of me that's kind of like, is a good guy that wants to be sober, you know. They say it's a spiritual malady, you know. I remember I was, you know, so I got, you know, I left the halfway house. I moved in with my buddies. I'm still going to AA. I'm not drinking, you know. I'm drinking near beer, though, you know. And I'm thinking, near beer is, you know, it tastes like real beer, you know. It's non-alcoholic, so, you know, it'll probably be okay. So I'm going to this meeting, and I remember there was this old fellow named Buzz. You know, he had like 30 years sober. He always made the coffee, and I helped him make the coffee. I felt like I was part AA, you know, hanging out with Buzz, you know. And then one day after like about a month or two, it was probably closer to 2 months, he goes, you know, how you doing with sobriety? And I was like, yeah, I'm doing pretty good, you know. I was like, you know, it's not that bad drinking the near beer. He's like, near beer? He's like, well, how much near beer do you drink? I said, I don't know, like five or six packs a day. He goes, a day? He goes, there's alcohol in that, you know? So then they talk about it in the meeting, you know? And it embarrassed me, you know? Because I remember there was this other old timer, and he's saying, you know, there's 0.05% alcohol in near beer, you know? And if you're drinking, you know, 24 to 30 cans of it a day, you know, you're drinking alcohol, you know, if you have an allergy to the body. And I was pissed, boy. After the meeting, I was pissed because I was like, I'm as sober as I've been in 10 years, you know, and they're telling me I'm not sober. That's what they were telling me. I was not sober. And so the next day, I'm going up to the beer and wine store to get my near beer, and then I'm like, you know, I'm good at math. I was like, all right, 0.05%. Real beer is 6% in Maryland, you know, so okay, so I'll just buy one real six-pack. I won't buy a case. I'll save some money. I won't have to piss so much. You know, I'll still not be drunk, because who can get drunk off of a six-pack, you know? And this is how my mind works. I don't know if anybody's done that, but this is how my mind works. And I'm like, well, you know what happened. I mean, you know, that lasted about 3 days, and then I was just buying a real case of beer and a bottle of Jack Daniels, you know, and I was off to the races, you know. And I wound up back in the bag, and I wouldn't come back to AA for about 5 years. I completely forgot about it, you know. I got married, I had a couple of kids, I got divorced, she left me because of my drinking, you know. Because my drinking progressed, it got worse, you know. I mean, I would say, I'll be home for dinner on Friday, you know. She would make dinner, I wouldn't come home till Sunday, you know. I would stop to have a few drinks, and then I'd disappear for 2 days. That's the kind of drunk I was, you know. Wasn't intentional, that's just the way I was, you know. I was a blackout drinker at that point. I would black out, and I don't know, I would end up in places, you know. Sometimes I would end up out of state, you know. I mean, I remember one time I woke up down and I woke up and I was like in a hotel room and there was booze bottles everywhere. I looked out the window and there was a statue of Robert E. Lee, you know. I mean, I live in Maryland, you know. we know who he is, but we don't have any statues of him there, that's for sure, you know what I mean? I always like to tell people it is south of the Mason-Dixon line, but not really. And I remember thinking, you know, you get that, it's kind of like a horror feeling inside. You know, I go, well, maybe I'm in Richmond. Richmond's not bad. It's only a couple hours away. Well, I was at the YMCA, Lee Square, you know, right outside the French Quarter in New Orleans. I'd gone back to my stomping ground, you know. You know, and I panicked. I didn't know what to do, you know. I mean, I had married some girl that I had met in AA. She was pregnant with our first child, you know. I was trying to be sober, but I wasn't. And, you know, we had started drinking together. And she ended up moving by herself, you know. You know, all the guys down on the river, you know, outside of the French Quarter knew me. I didn't know them. You know, I had apparently been there for 4 days making friends, you know, buying wine. I'd spent the rent money, you know. I mean, I left her with a paid moving van and a couple hundred dollars on the kitchen table and a note that said, you're better off without me. I don't remember writing it, you know. I left the car at the Metro, you know, and I called my business partner. At the time, I had a business partner. I was, like, building homes and stuff. I called my business partner and left him a message that I was going to Australia. So everybody thought I was in Australia. Thank God I didn't go to Australia. I don't know how I would have gotten back. You know, I didn't have all that much money. I tried to join the Navy. You know, I don't know if anybody's ever done this. You come off of a drunk and you're like in a panic. You don't have any money. You're in a strange city. You don't know what to do. So I tried to join the Navy. I went down to the Military Recruiting Center. It was a shopping mall right outside the, right on Canal Street. And it was like, I remember, this is how I made the decision too. I went down there and it was like, there was a Marine Corps guy and he was yelling at somebody. So he was out. The Army guy was sleeping. So he was out. And then I went by the Navy guys, and they were laughing and telling a bunch of jokes. And I said, well, they seem like good fellows. I'll join the Navy, you know. And I was really doing it just to, you know, kind of like save face. I thought, well, I got to do something about my drinking. If I join the Navy, I can clean myself up, you know, and everything will be all right. Thank God I got drunk before they actually took me. I took the test, you know. I remember telling the guy, I was like, I got to join the Navy. I was like, I got to join. You know, and I took the test, and he goes, oh, you scored really good. He goes, you might even be an officer one day. You know, I mean, I was basically, I dropped out of high school, you know. But I was pretty smart, you know. I came from smart people. And I told him I hadn't graduated high school, and he said they could help me with that. He said, well, when do you want to, you know, when do you want to go, you know, enlist? And I said, today. And he goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. He goes, we have to send back to Washington. We have to do a background check on you. I said, you don't need to do that. I said, I'm fine. I'm good. I said, just call my parents. They'll tell you I'm a good guy. And he didn't, you know, take that. He took me back to the YMCA, which was paid up through the end of the week. And I ended up, you know, getting drunk one more time, taking a bus to Atlanta with the rest of the money I had. And this is how, I don't know why I'm telling this story. I've been thinking a lot about this week, just how crazy and insane this was, you know. Because I was sharing this with Stevie and Johnny's niece, you know, about the way we used to be. So I ended up, coming back. And, of course, I got sober again for a little while. This is what I would do. I would get sober for a little while, and then, as soon as the heat was off, I would go back to drinking, Now, what happened in 1990? By that time, I had had three children with this second woman who I'm still married to, Maureen. Maureen and I will be married 27 years this December, which is, I have to say, women are the ones who keep marriages together, because men are fools. Men are fools, and she's been very tolerant of me. And I love her. I mean, I've been madly in love with her since she was 18 years old, I met her in AA when she was 18, and then we got married, And we drank together for a few years, and then she got sober, And then I got sober a couple of years later. I don't know how she lived with me those last 2 years. Well, I know how. She didn't have any money, and I did go to work, and I would pay the bills and stuff like that. And that was my last vestige of denial, was that, I pay the bills and I'll drink the way I damn well please, And she likes to tell me I was a good provider, but I've taken my own inventory. I was not a good provider. I could have spent that money on a lot better things, I mean, I did the best I could, I probably did better than some people and worse than others, But I really was not I wasn't a good father. I wasn't a good husband, I wasn't a good son. I wasn't a good employee, And that's what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got so bad at the end of my drinking that by this time I'm 31 years old, and I'd tried everything to enjoy and control my drinking, even using drugs, There was a period in my late 20s where I started using heroin to control my drinking, which sounds crazy, but it made sense to me at the time. I had maybe a year period where I was using heroin on and off to control my drinking. And then I almost died. I was left for dead by a friend of mine on my 27th birthday, And I woke up in a pile of puke. And I came home and my kids, I only had two kids then. My wife was pregnant with the first one, my second marriage, my third child, and my older kids from my first marriage were living with me, and because I'd gotten divorced from my first wife, and they made me a birthday party, with hats and everything. I said, "Happy birthday, Dad," and I was out shooting drugs, and almost dying the night before, and this is the difference for me between an alcoholic and a drug addict. I don't consider myself a drug addict, although I have not done any drugs in the 22 years almost that I've been sober. No mood-altering chemicals other than coffee. I would say coffee's a mood-altering chemical, but, I've never gotten a, driving while coffee. Not yet, anyway. I just said I won't do drugs. I will not, and it was not a problem for me. But it would be another 4 years before I could put down the booze, And I was so bad in the end. And what happened is I became unemployed and unemployable, I lost my job. She just had another baby. I knew that I had to go get a job right away, because she couldn't work. She just had a baby, And I was drunk every day by 10 a.m., And I was one of those guys at the end where I drank vodka, cheap as possible, Vladimir, Aristocrat, something like that, what I mean? I mean, this stuff is hard to take, I mean, it's, rubbing alcohol, I think, probably tastes better than that stuff. But it was cheap. So I'd go get my half a pint of, Pop-Off or Aristocrat. I don't know why I always bought a half a pint, because I always, every day, ended up drinking a quart to a half gallon. That's the kind of alcoholic I am. And I ended up, inadvertently saying a prayer in front of this liquor store in Wheaton, And I said, I was hearing things, I was seeing things. I was exactly where that guy was that died next to me, It was 11 years later, and I was exactly where he was at. Only I was 20 years younger than him. I was 31 years old. I've been told at 30 that I had the onset of cirrhosis of the liver, My liver enzymes were off the charts, And I lied to my doctor. He's like, "Do you drink?" And I said, "A couple, not very often, I mean, he knew I was lying, But, you know what? Doctors cannot do anything for us if we don't tell them the truth, And I didn't. He was my family doctor. He'd been my family doctor since I was like 6 years old. And he knew I was killing myself with alcoholism. So he just let me go, you know. But I ended up getting sober by, I went to this, I said a prayer, God help me, I can't take it anymore. I had a thought to go to this meeting. This is where my sponsor, Mike, would be that day. And Mike, my sponsor, Mike, died 5 years ago in August of 2007. And he was the perfect sponsor for me, you know. I don't know why, but him and I could communicate. You know, I felt like I could tell him the truth, you know. And if you haven't found somebody like that yet, you know, I hope that you do. I went to the meeting. I sat through the meeting. I don't remember what they said, but after the meeting, I pulled them aside and I said, I said, I have to get sober. I said, I can't live like this anymore. I can't take this. And he said, he looked me dead in the eye. He said, I can't help you. He said, if you don't have a higher power, because you're going to die. If you don't have God in your understanding. And I said, shot back at him very sternly. I said, you don't understand. I said, I do not believe in God. God is for suckers. I don't believe in God. I said, I was raised with God. I said, I've seen too many terrible things in my life. There is no God. I see the way human beings treat each other. There's no God. There is no God. And I started to walk away. And he grabbed me like we often do. He grabbed me on my shoulder and he pulled me around. And he said, well, let's go have a cup of coffee. Now, I found out later on he had an appointment to go to. But he dropped everything and he came and sat with me. You know, and this is what good AAs do, you know. He said, well, how'd you get here? I said, well, I was sitting in front of the liquor store. I said, and I said, I was feeling so bad. I said, Maureen had a baby, and she just was staring daggers at me. I said, she looked like she hated me, you know, and the kids look like they hate me. And I don't, you know, I love my children, and I love my wife, and what's wrong with me? And he said, well, how'd you get here? I said, well, I said a prayer, you know, God help me, and then I had this thought to come here, and, you know, and then I asked you for help, you know. And he goes, wait a minute. You know, this is how we are. We have to point it out to people. He goes, wait a minute. You said a prayer, and then you had a thought to come here. He goes, when's the last time you've been in an AA meeting? I said, I don't know, about 9 or 10 months, maybe a year. He said, and then you asked me for help. And he goes, congratulations, you just did the first three steps. And I remember, I did not do the first three steps. But I remember feeling like, I did the first three steps. You know what I mean? Because that's how we are too, you know. I said, well, I did the first three steps, you know. I said, well, what do you want me to do? He goes, I don't want to hear anything about your wife or your kids or, you know, some debauchery you're involved in. He goes, I just want you to show up at my house at 8 o'clock. And he goes, can you follow direction? And that was it. And I said, yeah, I can do that, I think. I said, I've never followed direction. I said, but I'll try, you know. And I didn't tell him that my van had blown up, you know, I'd lost my job, you know. I had no money, I was about to get evicted, you know. I would walk to his house every day, and it was pretty far, it was like 5 miles, you know. And I did that for almost 2 weeks before somebody else noticed that I was walking because they'd seen me on the road. And he's like, well, how'd you get here? I said, well, I walked. I said, I don't remember anything for a bus. He goes, you walk? He goes, well, he goes, you've been coming for 2 weeks. We'll get somebody to pick you up. He goes, I'm not picking you up, though. And we started going through the steps, you know. And, you know, when I was 2 months sober, he had me do an inventory, you know. He had me say that prayer every day. He's like, just keep saying that prayer, God help me, and then come here. And, you know, a lot has happened in my sobriety. I'm going to talk about my sobriety now. I did get sober. I stayed sober. I like to say my first 2 years of sobriety, my life got worse, but I got better. I lost my house. It seemed like every piece of equipment I had blew up. I had no vehicle to drive. That sober wife that I had that was 2 years sober, she left me. She moved home with her mother to her mother's farm. Her mother had a farm up in Frederick County, Maryland. Which was actually, I felt terrible about that at the time. My little girls were like all under five, you know, the three ones that Maureen and I had. But you know what? They loved it, you know. Her parents lived next to the biggest dairy farm in Frederick County, you know, and every day they would spend their days in the barns, you know, seeing sheep be born, or, you know, helping them milk the cows, or, you know, whatever. They just had a blast. I mean, you know, they tell me that now, okay, as grown women, you know. But it, to me, it just ached me, you know. I called my mother up. I said, "Mom, I don't have anywhere to go. I'm homeless." She said, "Well, you can sleep on my sofa." My dad didn't want to let me, you know. He was sick of my ass. He didn't even talk to me anymore. But she let me sleep on her sofa, and I went to meetings all the time, and I started doing the steps, you know. I owed a lot of money to the IRS. I mean, a lot of money, you know. I did a lot of work on my own, and I didn't pay taxes on it, you know. And my sponsor, Mike, made me write them on the list, along with my family. You know, the list, the A-step list, you know, is basically, it's people that loved you or trusted you, you know. People that I stole from or lied to, you know. My wife, my parents, my children. You know, I owed the IRS over $87,000, you know. And I remember I was, I think right around 2 years sober, and my family had just gotten back together. We moved into a house, you know, and the IRS contacted me because I had an address again. They sent me a letter. "We want to talk to you about it." And I called, this is how knuckleheaded we are. I called Mike up and I said, "The IRS contacted me." He said, "Oh, really?" He goes, "What do you think you should do?" And I said, "Well, you know," I said, "Maureen's happy." I said, "The kids are in good school." I said, "Everything's going pretty good." I said, "But I guess I could move." This is 2 years sober. I'm 2 years sober. And he started laughing. He goes, "No." He goes, "This is great. This is great." He goes, "You call them up. You tell them you want to talk to them about it, and you want to make an arrangement to pay them back." And I remember looking at the phone and going, "Is he crazy? I'll be spending the rest of my life paying them off, you know, with penalty and interest and stuff like that." Well, you know what? I found out that they're not as big an ogre as you think, you know. I did, you know, they did. They laid it on at first. But after a while, they saw that I was doing the effort. And they erased some of that interest and penalty, you know. And they told me when I was done, you know. When I was done paying them off, you know, it took me 8 years to become solvent again in sobriety. You know? And, you know, things started getting better, you know. I mean, you know, my older children, you know, they were around. And, you know, I made amends to my ex-wife, you know, who just, I mean, she hated me so much, my first wife, you know. She used to call me up when I was still drinking and go, "I wish that you would die so I could collect Social Security." She goes, "Can you hurry up and do that?" And I would, every time I would get off the phone with her, I would think, "But I love you." You know, and more, I kind of have that effect on women, just by the way that I act, you know. I remember when I was 6 months sober, my wife Maureen, she told me that the last 3 months of her pregnancy with our youngest daughter, Heidi, who was born two weeks before I got sober, so she's never seen me drunk. She said she was sleeping with a butcher knife every night under the pillow. And I remember I called Mike up and I was like, "She told me she's sleeping with a butcher knife under the pillow." And he looks at me without even batting an eye and he goes, "Well, she's a passionate woman." It took me another year and a half to ask her why she was sleeping with a pillow. I thought she was afraid of me. This is how we are. I thought she was afraid of me. And she said, "No." She said, "I wasn't afraid of you." She goes, "You were drunk every day by like 10 a.m. She goes, "I hated you. I wanted to stab you to death. But I knew that I couldn't because I was sober." And I thought to myself, thank God she never went to Al-Anon. When I was 10 years sober, my boy, Brendan, he was my only boy, my oldest child. He died in a drowning accident out in Colorado. And like I said, I was 10 years sober. And things were going pretty good. I thought things were going to be smooth for the rest of my life. You know? But you know, life sometimes deals you a card, you know. And I had just been on a trip with him and three of his sisters. His sister from my first marriage, Nicole, she's actually now a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, 5 years sober now. She has two little boys of her own, you know. But she was a hellion when she was a teenager. I mean, I got everything that I had given my parents back, you know, from that girl. And she had come with me on this. She was like one of these, like, raver kids, you know, like hanging out in these, you know, raves and stuff, dropping ecstasy and all that kind of stuff. She had come out on a trip with him, and he was not a drinker. He was not a drug user. He was a high school All-American. He was a track star. Him and his buddies, they had become high school All-Americans in North Carolina where he lived, you know. He ended up going to this college down there in outside of Raleigh called St. Augustine. I didn't know anything about St. Augustine, you know, but I come to find out that it was an all-black college, okay. And he went there because his two best friends went there, you know, and they all got scholarships to go there. But they didn't really have a cross-country program, and he was like a cross-country. He was more of like a cross-country runner, you know, middle distance and cross-country, you know. But lo and behold, his freshman year, they voted him freshman of the year, which I always got a chuckle out of, you know. And I said, the first time I went down to visit there, I was like, you know, I didn't know anything about it. I had dropped out of high school. I didn't know anything about college, you know. I went down there. I was like, wow. I was like, this is an all-black college. And he goes, no, it's not. He goes, I go here. And he goes, and there's three other white people here. And I said, okay. I said, why did you want to come here? And he goes, well, he goes, Victor and Tron were coming here. And he goes, and they're my best buds. And he goes, I thought I could help the cross-country program. And he goes, and I wanted to see what it was like to be the minority. And he goes, and I said, well, how is it? And he goes, it's kind of hard. He goes, you know, there's some kids that told me they thought that I won the freshman of the year just because I'm white. And he goes, and I know that's not the case. I said, well, what are you going to do? And he goes, I could come back and stick it out for a few more years. He goes, but I found this other school out in Colorado, and I want to go out there. He goes, because they've been cross-country national champions 3 years in a row. This was in the late 90s, early 2000s. I said, I want to go there. And I said, okay. I said, well, you know, call him up and see if you can come out there, you know. And, you know, he needed quite a bit of money, and I didn't have it. I had just gotten solvent again, you know. I was working towards, you know, we had a nice house that, you know, we were starting to fix up, and the kids were little, and, you know, Maureen and I's kids were little. And he ended up taking a year off, which he was mad at me about, you know. But we had kind of, like, made up, you know. I remember we had a fight on the way out there, and I remember I regretted this for a couple of years after he passed. I remember I got out of he was driving like 90 miles an hour while I was taking a nap, you know, and his two little sisters and, you know, his one that's a year younger than him were in the back seat, and I was like, you know, pull over, you know. I was I felt like a dad again, you know. And he got out, and I remember he looked at me and he, like, you know, puffed his chest out, and I said, do you think you can take me? I said, I don't think so, not yet. It's gonna take another 10 or 20 years. And he says, I got to get there. He goes, I got to train. You don't understand. You know, 2 weeks, you know, we're starting, you know, training camp, and I got to be ready in the altitude. And I said, and I said to him, I said, the only thing you have to do is live and die. And then he died a week later. He did. He drowned in the lake. And I found his body a week later, and I had driven all the way across the country, and I found out that he was missing in this lake. He'd gone to a party, and they'd been drinking. You know, he never drank. He had just turned 21. He was drinking that night. You know, when I recovered his body a week later, he had a blood alcohol of 2.0. So he was pretty drunk, you know. And I wasn't angry. I was just really disappointed, is what I was. And I was really so sad. I was, I've never felt that much pain in my life. I don't know if anybody here has ever lost a child, but it was more pain than I could probably endure. And there's a friend of mine named Dave back home. He was a plumber, you know, and Dave and I had grown up together. He was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He got me all these numbers, all these people in this little town called Gunnison, Colorado. And I started going down the list. There was like six people. Nobody answered their phone. And it was not very late at night. It was like 9 o'clock at night. And, you know, I went down to the police station because I wanted to see if they'd found out anything, you know. And it's not like, you know, it's probably like it is down here. You know, the police station out there, they close down at like 8 o'clock at night, you know. Where I'm from, they stay open 24/7, you know. I'm from the city, you know, and I thought that they would. And I was standing right next to a bar, and it was a bar that he had told me that he'd gone to shoot pool with his friends sometimes, you know, on the weekends when they had time off class. And I wandered in there, and a guy, the bartender, came over to me. He was holding Jack Daniel's Black Label, you know. And this is the situation that I hope nobody in here runs into, but I did, you know. It talks about in the book, you know, how there'll come a time when there's only, you know, there's only you and your higher power that's in between that drink, you know. And that was that time for me, you know. He said, "Do you want a shot of this?" And I looked him dead in the eye, and I said, "Yeah." I said, "But give me 1 minute." And I paused for a second, and I walked out, and I walked up to the payphone, and I started throwing quarters in a column, and nobody answered, nobody answered, nobody answered. The last guy I called was a guy named Charlie, and this is how my higher power works. This is, you know, this is a true story. This is how he, you know, this is the God of my understanding. You know. Charlie got on the phone. I said, "I can't get in touch with my sponsor." I said, "My name's Bill. You know, I'm sober 10 years. I said, "My boy's the one who's missing in that lake." And I said, "I want to take a drink so bad that I can taste it." I said, "I'm standing, you know, right on the corner, right outside this bar, Timbers." And he said, "Don't do that. That's stupid. Don't do that." And this guy didn't know me. He didn't know me from Adam. And I said, "Okay." And he said, "You know, meet me for coffee at this other place." And we had coffee, you know. And I come to find out that Charlie, he was the county coroner. If and when I found the body, he was going to be the one who took care of my boy, you know. And we did. The next day, we found him at like 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, search and rescue did. I was there. Charlie let me sit with him. You know, it was horrible. It was horrible, you know. I didn't even recognize him at first, you know. And both my wives were out there, his mother and my wife that I'm married to now, but neither one of them saw that, and I wouldn't let them see him, you know. But I carried that with me, you know. I took care of business. I brought him home, you know. I buried him in the family plot, you know. You know, I grieved. I spent a few weeks, I don't know, this is what I did. I don't know about other people, but I went out every day for almost a month, and I read Walt Whitman. I don't know why. It just seemed to help me, you know, because I like poetry. And, you know, I went back there the next year, and I wasn't even sure why. You know, I said, I want to go back out there. And Mike was like, "Why?" I said, "I don't know why. I just feel like I need to, you know." And they had the worst drought in Colorado history. That where the river and the lake, you know, came together, where he drowned, this off this bridge, where he jumped off this bridge. It's kind of like jumping in a quarry is what it was, you know. But it lost 40 feet of water, and there was a big pipe, like one of those like roadside things that they have in the winter, and somebody had either knocked it in the river, or it had been thrown in there or something by somebody, and it was sticking straight up. And I thought, and I had my answer, you know, because I had asked God to tell me what happened, you know. And I thought, this is what he hit his head on. You know, this is why he drowned, you know. It wasn't because he was drunk, it's because he hit his head on this, you know. And I went by to see Charlie, and Charlie was just getting ready to retire, you know. His name is, people like to call him CJ, you know. CJ had been, him and his family have been the county coroners in Gunnison County since the 1820s. He was the last of his generation. He had two boys. One of them had died in an accident 21 years earlier, you know. And he told me this. that year before. What he didn't tell me was that night that I had called him was his son's birthday, the one that had died 21 years earlier, you know. And the hair on the back of my neck stood up. And me and Charlie were both crying, you know. He's kind of a tough guy like me, you know. He's, one of these pioneer men, you know. And he was 17 years sober, you know, when I made that phone call to him. He said, "Isn't that a strange coincidence?" He said, I said, "No, Charlie." I said, "I think God sent you to me and me to you, you know." And we cried and we hugged, you know. And I still didn't feel real good about it, you know. But I asked God to help me with that, you know. I took a trip out to Hawaii, and I was on the Nepali coast, and I sat there for quite a while, a couple of hours, you know, praying and meditating. I just needed to know, because I've always had this feeling, you know, there can't be a God, you know. Even though I was raised, you know, in a religion, you know, my parents are both practicing Catholics, you know, they have their beliefs, you know, and I've talked to a lot of people about a lot of different things, you know. I thought there can't be a God that cares about us, you know. But I was sitting there for the longest time, and over the water I saw his face, and he said to me, "It's okay, Dad." He said, "I'm happy." Mm-hmm. And it was as real as, like, me and Billy talking, or me and Sam talking, you know. It was, you know. And ever since then, I've had peace about him dying, you know. And I ended up going back out to that bridge where he drowned, you know. And I found myself, I was very angry for the longest time. I was very angry. I went through the grief process. And I found myself thanking God for giving him to me, you know. Because really, I mean, if I think back on it, you know, him being born saved my life. I was so less crazy the minute he was born, you know. Like I've heard before, you know, I mean, you know, people that love us, you know, can make us want to be better people. You know, I wanted to be a better person than I was, you know. But my alcoholism just kept me from doing that, you know. I think the difference between being sober and being drunk is, you know, the difference between living without love and living with love, you know. Mm-hmm. This is the way I think God intended us to live, you know. Where we share our lives with each other, where we help each other, you know. I don't just help people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I found that I've gotten into such a habit of helping others that was really facilitated by my first sponsor. You know, he was the one who was constantly saying, "Who are you helping today?" You know, I find myself helping people that are not alcoholics. You know, just because it's become nature, second nature to me. You know, my daughter, his sister, got sober 5 years ago. My wife and I were coming back from a trip. We had gone to Costa Rica with some sober people, had a great time. You know, we had some trouble in our marriage after my son died. I became very kind of despondent. I wouldn't talk to anybody for about a year, you know. I mean, I wouldn't talk to anybody. That's hard to live with, you know. And we ended up, like, separating for a year. I moved out, you know. And, you know, I probably did some things I shouldn't have done, but... you know, I've always been rather a reckless person, you know. You know, my compulsion does not stop with alcohol, you know. I mean, I can become addicted to Ben and Jerry's, you know. I mean, I can remember one year while I was drinking, I was not drinking, I was eating like 2 pints of Ben and Jerry's every night, you know. I mean, I was, you know that flavor Chubby Hubby? It was happening. It was happening at my house, you know. So the longer I'm sober, the healthier I get, you know. We were coming back from that trip, and my daughter Nicole called me. I was in the Atlanta airport, and she said, "Did your friends tell you?" And I was like, "Oh, my God, what is it now? Tell me what." She goes, "I'm an alcoholic, and I've joined AA." And I started laughing. I said, "No, I just got back in the country." I said, but I'm happy for that. She goes, "Did you know?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I've known for about 10 years." And she said, "You never said anything to me." And that's true. I never told her she was an alcoholic. Now, when she wrecked one of my cars, I would bring her to meetings with me. You know, That would be like a consequence. Okay. Okay, I remember one time she wrecked a car into a curb and she popped two front tires. She was trying to change it. Shit-faced drunk, her cousin called me up and said, you got to go get her. So I went up. Thank God she didn't get a DWI. She's changing one tire and I grabbed her, you know, because I'm still like, you know, I get a little angry sometimes. So I grabbed her by the hair and threw her in the truck. And she goes, what are you doing? She goes, I can drive home. I said, I don't know how. You only got one spare and two flat tires. You know, but it's funny. She came and made amends to me. And, you know, I made amends to her long before that, you know. And we just have a wonderful life together, you know. This year has been a little bit difficult, you know. 18 months ago, and I'm almost near the end. I've been real sick for a little while, and I come to find out that I have this rare blood disorder called PNH, you know, and it almost killed me Easter of last year. You know, I wound up in the hospital. I had blood clots in every vital organ. I was on the verge of a heart attack or a stroke, you know, and so many people in AA showed up and helped me, you know. My sponsor was there all the time. You know, the life I have today is, nobody would have come to see me when I was drunk, you know what I mean? This July, I have a daughter in graduate school in Pennsylvania, at the University of Penn. Wicked smart girl, just like my dad, you know. She's getting a PhD in microbiology, virology and parasitology, whatever the hell that is. I don't really understand it, but she loves being a scientist. But, you know, and she kind of had a trouble with drinking when she was young, and she just stopped on her own. I mean, she's so much like me. It's unbelievable, you know. She doesn't believe in God, you know. What is this, you know? She's very, you know, science oriented. But at the end of July, she tried to take her own life. She'd been drinking for 6 months again, after stopping on her own for 4 years. So it's progressive. I was so upset about that. I can't tell you. My beautiful daughter, Katie. And, you know, I've let my wife handle that, you know. And the youngest one, who I thought would be the biggest trouble, you know, is the one who ended up saving her life, you know. She got some psychiatric help. She's come to AA, I wouldn't say willing, but she has a temporary sponsor. she sees that she's admitted that she might have a problem with alcohol, you know. But I know that that's not what this is. This is not it's not a problem with alcohol. You know, I always like to tell people, I have a not drinking problem, mm-hmm. A not drinking problem, you know. And that's where Katie was at, you know. And hopefully she's on the road to recovery, you know. I mean, I just spent the weekend with her and her son, and, you know, I mean, I love them both so much, you know. That's what AA has done for me. So anyway, thanks for listening to me.